I'm going to start this episode by thanking Mr. James Gearing, who's the guest on today's show, for not only being on this show, but allowing me to be on his, which I don't know how I got there, but he hosts the show Behind the Shield. This podcast has been on for several years. You probably heard about him only because he's got over 750 episodes. I think we're over 800 by the time we get to this one, and way beyond 5 million downloads. He's had all kinds of guests from all kinds of backgrounds. What he does is very dynamic. And I was honored to have him on. A little bit of a background if you don't know about this guy. He's a former firefighter, stuntman, and he also has a degree in exercise physiology. So there's a lot going on there. He's a Brit. He's from England, but he's been living in the United States since 2002, and he spent 14 years as a firefighter and paramedic, serving on both the East and the West Coast. We talk a lot of different things. We kind of go a lot of different directions, and that's what I love most about my conversation with James in this particular episode, the one I did with him, and then even in the phone chats that we've had. Very interesting guy, huge heart, very passionate about spreading the good word to people in general, but specifically to the members of the first responder community. I had a great time with this. I hope you guys enjoy listening to it as much as I had fun putting it together. Again, Mr. James Gearing, Behind the Shield podcast. Just need to take a couple minutes to thank the sponsors for today's show. You know, the older kids taught me a lesson early in life, and that was snitches get stitches. We kids wanted things we said and did in the absence of outside eavesdropping eyes and ears to remain private and secure within our little neighborhood tribe. After all, this information was private, and we were sworn to keep it secure so it didn't get exploited in the wrong hands. Nowadays, my private information has expanded beyond that little group of bike riding marauders and now sits available on all my electronic devices. And that makes me feel pretty uneasy, especially after having my phone and personal accounts hacked and taken advantage of. The reality for you and me is our laptops are never really off. Our phones hold our entire lives, including family and work, and everything from credit cards to passports contain RFID. All of this effectively makes those little items little snitches. And this makes us all vulnerable to having our digital lives stolen. It's time to put a stop to that. And this is where Cylent comes in. That's S-L-N-T. Cylent offers a range of sleek RFID blocking wallets, EDC Faraday bags, travel gear, laptop sleeves, and key fob cases with the added protection of their patented Cylent Pocket Faraday Cage technology. This elite signal blocking technology is the easiest way to instantly enhance your peace of mind around how your mobile devices are screwing your digital life up. My personal favorites are the Cylent Faraday phone and laptop sleeve. They give me peace of mind by allowing me to completely disconnect from anything incoming and or outgoing, including things that can negatively impact my financial, physical, psychological, and emotional health. So, if you're looking for a solution to reclaiming your personal privacy, security, and health, go check out Cylent.com. That's S-L-N-T.com. You can follow them at GoSilent on Instagram and Twitter, and then use the code IronSights at checkout for an exclusive discount. Guys, if you're over 30, you're going to want to hear this. Every year after puberty, HGH, human growth hormone, the master hormone responsible for workout recovery, performance, metabolism, and even libido, starts to decline. Doesn't matter who you are, how you train, or how good you eat, it's happening to all of us all the time. And that's where BioPro Plus comes in. BioPro Plus is the first of its kind non-synthetic alternative to prescription HGH growth hormone treatments. All the benefits of HGH without any of the needles, side effects, or doctor visits. Best part is BioPro Plus works super fast, is easy to use, and is 100% safe. It's been trusted by physicians since 2009, and its benefits can be felt in just days instead of months. Here's what else you should know. If you listen to this show, you know I'm very particular about what I put into my body. Over the years, my understanding of the science behind this stuff and other things, and having had my own experiences, I needed to know. So the BioPro Plus team sent me a 30-day supply, which included a morning and nighttime liquid formula. I simply hold these under my tongue for about 90 seconds before I swallow it. And right away, the quality of my sleep was better. My libido shot through the roof. Recovery from my workouts was improved, and my overall sense of well-being has been markedly different. And we're talking days, not weeks or months. Bottom line, this was the only change I made in my diet, workouts, and lifestyle during this little personal experiment. And I feel fucking fantastic. All this with no needles, no prescriptions, no weird shit to worry about like when using exogenous hormones or anabolics. If you know, you know. So if you want to fix the way you perform, look, and feel, go to bioproteintech.com or follow them at bioproteintech. When you get there, use code IRONSIGHTS for $30 off your order. Welcome to IRONSIGHTS After Dark. During my 25 plus years in the fitness industry, I've always been passionate about expanding my physical, mental, and heart skills to be prepared for whatever life might throw at me. from fitness to firearms and beyond. Taking a holistic approach to being prepared has led me on a journey to seek and share both knowledge and skills from expert resources in the civilian, LEO, military, and first responder communities. The mission of this podcast is to help others expand their capabilities and knowledge of preparedness while building strength in the community that shares similar goals and values. So ultimately, we contribute together and grow together. Welcome back to the Iron Sights podcast. I have Mr. James Gearing from the Behind the Shield podcast on the show today. Stoked to have you, James. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. I think it's like deja vu Groundhog Day, isn't it? We were doing this just literally 24 hours ago, but you were the interviewee at that point.
Yeah, I'm honored to have you, as honored as I was to be interviewed by you the other day. It's always interesting sitting on the other side of the mic. I actually don't get to do that very often. So, but to be, you know, sort of on your show, which I've followed for a very long time. You are one of the OGs, I would say, sort of in this space. How many episodes does Behind the Shield actually have now?
I think I posted episode 906 yesterday. So, you know, the next big number is 1,000.
That is impressive. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. And it's I don't know about you. I get questions all the time from aspiring podcasters or people that are kind of thinking about doing it. It usually starts with like, what equipment do I need and things like that. And some of the advice I got, you know, when I started asking those questions, like just get going, get started, put some content together. And, you know, when you get to 100 episodes, you'll know. you'll kind of figure things out. So I'm interested to hear about your journey because I think we just launched episode 250. So I'm not even like 25, I'm basically barely 25% of the way there, I guess, to catching up with you. But enough about me. For those people that don't know you, I like to kind of start these conversations really simply by allowing the guests to sort of talk about themselves. And so what I say is, I'd love to know a little bit more about you and get the audience to know you a bit. You can start and finish wherever you'd like in your story. You just have to be patient with me because I will likely time you out or cut you off to maybe get a little bit more detail or understand things a little bit better. So that said, ready, set, go.
All right. It was 29th of March, 1974. It was a breech birth.
I love it. Let's go settle in. I'm ready.
No, the real overview I think that I give most people is I grew up in the most amazing upbringing. And I talk about this a lot because it doesn't mean that there wasn't hardship and things. There really were. There were things that happened, the death experiences and stuff. But I grew up, my dad was a veterinary surgeon. So I grew up on a farm and we had stables and that's where he had the horses. But then he had a small animal practice. So after school, we'd end up going there and, you know, helping him with surgeries and all kinds of things. And it was a very eclectic upbringing. The veterinary world, everyone has animals. So we literally would see people walk through the doors of the farmhouse, which is like this, kind of reminds me of a British sitcom. You just never know who was going to burst through the door. But it could be, you know, we had gypsies, that one of my dad's friends and one of my most favorite humans ever was a blacksmith of the kind of gypsy culture. Just amazing human being all the way through to extended royal family, polo horses and things. So you also got a really unique lens on really that there's only two types of people. There's nice people and there's shitbags. That's it. And you know, then you can deconstruct the shitbags. Why are they like that in the first place? And ultimately, yep, we're all supposed to be nice people. But it kind of totally dispelled that myth about money and power and status and all that stuff. You know, you just saw people for people. So that was a really interesting, awesome upbringing. I was one of five kids. So, you know, I was the oldest brother. And so I got a really, you know, really immersive childhood. I was on a farm, so I was around nature. I was around healing. I was around gore. We had this big kitchen table that we'd make fun of each other around, you know, all meals. So it really kind of actually prepared me very well for the fire service later in life. But what the stumbling block was when I was in high school age-ish, we had the annual medicals and they were told me I was colorblind. And they literally said, you can't be a pilot, you can't be a firefighter, you can't be like everything I thought would be a cool thing. And I dreamed about being a firefighter for a long time. They took off the table. And when you're young, someone with a stethoscope and a white coat, that's gospel to you.
Yep.
So I fumbled around for a long time, ended up being a lifeguard first. And then I fell in love with a girl when I was at summer camps. So I used to work in summer camps for 6 years. And she was from England, ironically. So I ended up going into drama school just so I could be near her because she was doing the costume and set design. Got into acting, realized I was absolutely awful at acting. I will put my hand on my heart. And ever since Netflix, I mean, there's worse actors out there than me even. I'm still pretty bad. But I got into the stunt side. We did stage combat with the swords and everything. And that I was just good at. And I was a martial artist. So that, long story short, led me to traveling with that girl around the world. And when I got to Australia, there was an audition for stunt performers to open Universal Studios in Japan. So on a whim, went down, auditioned. And about 2 months later, I was in Japan working. So became a stunt man, broke up with the previous girl, which we had before we even got to Japan. Met an American girl. We ended up getting married. And that brought me to the States. And then, very long story, very short, I had an epiphany at my mid-20s. Like, I can see color. What were they talking about? And it took me that long to figure that out. I'm a ding-dong.
So hold on. Time out for a second. So this is a fact. So you weren't actually colorblind. This is like a misdiagnosis.
It's literally like saying you're either blind, Stevie Wonder blind, or you've got perfect 20/20 vision. That's the way that they talk to people about color vision, certainly back then. So what happens is in the middle, there are people that literally see in black and white, chromo, whatever it's called. But I was just off. So like I always said, I probably wouldn't be a great fashion designer because my chartreuse and my, green is off. But that's it. I can tell the lights and all that stuff. And that's what they want. They want you to know, roughly that. But if it's an obscure color of a car, maybe I'll get the maroon and the brown mixed up a little bit. But it's the one with the, the lamppost sticking out of it. Okay, that's the way to go and help the people in.
Right.
So that was it. But I think it's an important part of the story because it really showed me. Because then I ended up going to the fire academy, doing a medical for it. The doctor pulls out that book and I just said, look, I'm not going to be able to tell you all the numbers in there, but point to anything in this room. I'll tell you what color it is. That's how it went. I got a big check next to my name.
And
that was the beginning. Mm. But I think it's an important takeaway because how many people are told they can't by someone they think is an expert in that field? And then, whether it's Navy SEALs that had a criminal background, whatever it is, until you find out someone found a way around it. Not in a bad way, just someone figured out a way to navigate that hurdle so you could still go doing that thing that you were destined to do. Yeah. So that's why I think it's, I put that in my book and it's an important part of the story because I think, we don't hear enough of you can be anything these days, and sadly, not getting political, but even some of the things that people dreamed of becoming, like presidents, not such a prestigious position anymore based on who has made the cut.
No.
So I think, if you have something burning in your heart, but your grades or your physical or whatever came back, now look at the adaptive world. Look at the amazing humans that have said, yeah, I've only got one leg, but hold my beer, here we go.
So
that was kind of my journey into the American Fire Service.
So before we sort of get into the, you touched on a few things there, but before we get into the fire service journey, interesting what you said there about there's not enough of us telling people that they can do or be whatever they want to do or be. It's almost kind of gotten perverted a little bit in that we're saying you are whatever you want to be versus having to work through becoming whatever you want to be. And without getting overly political, when we look at just the messages that are going out there and kind of what's we're being told we need to generally accept, not only we're not telling the person that they can be something in their life, whatever it is, whether that's the president or a firefighter, we're telling them whatever you decide you are today, that's what you are, and we have to recognize you as that. That is where we've gotten to, which is obviously very challenging for me, but the overcoming, having somebody else tell you though, at the same time, like, actually you're okay. Like you could do this, and how that changes your life and your life journey. It, had you not gotten into the fire service, because I want to go down that path. What would you have done? What would have happened?
So I mean, I was on that path, you know, until America. So what happened was the same thing I think that a lot of people talk about when they transition out of the military, that feeling of lack of purpose, of being lost. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, sometimes you're just destined to do a thing. Now, ironically, 14 years later, I'm behind a microphone for a living, but there's another story that we'll get into. But mm-hmm. But yeah, so I really, when I look back now, there was this definite feeling of being lost. And that doesn't mean that you weren't good at the things that you were doing in the meantime. You know, like I was a good lifeguard and I was a good stuntman, which people that I work with have told me, it's not my own self, you know, observation. But, you know, so being successful, one thing isn't necessarily a metric on if it's what you really meant to do or what you really want to do. So I think I would have, if I hadn't become a firefighter, it would have still involved some sort of healing. Because it's kind of funny. When I was little, I used to watch The Fall Guy, which there's a movie they just made coming out, which I can't wait to watch. So I wanted to be a stuntman. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a firefighter, and I wanted to be a pirate. Well, yeah, I became a firefighter. And then in America, ultimately, I became a paramedic as well, firefighter paramedic. And when I was young, it was my academic ability that stopped me from going into medicine, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't actually, that wasn't the thing that I wanted to do. When I look back now, it wasn't sitting behind a desk writing prescriptions. It was cutting holes in people's throats and trying to save them on the side of a road. So yep. I ended up becoming that. And then even the funny thing is, as a pirate, as I played a pirate as a stuntman in Orlando too. So I actually checked.
You did it all. You checked all those
boxes.
I love it. So, okay. So let's transition into the fire service in the United States and that process. I mean, I'm very naive to, you know, maybe, you know, coming to America to go into a service like the fire service or law enforcement. I may have met two folks maybe in my years that, you know, were not born and raised here in America that became, you know, police officers or firefighters. Talk about that. I mean, you're already obviously already had experience, but maybe you can compare and contrast like the entry into this and kind of what it looks and feels like maybe culturally as compared to other places, because I've never heard anybody talk about that.
So there are some barriers to entry. When you first come over here, you know, the legal way, and again, I'll preface that with I came from a country where I had the environment and the means to legally move to America. Mm-hmm. I wasn't fleeing Haiti or somewhere, so that's not in any way, shape, or form, you know, me judging anyone who doesn't come that way. But, you know, it's expensive and it's a very long process. And when I went through, so I was emigrating in 2002, so not long after 9/11. So, you know, you imagine all the bureaucracy that are built up then.
Things had changed.
Yeah. So I went through Fire Academy, graduated, but some departments like the City of Orlando, you had to be an actual American citizen. A lot of departments, if you were a permanent resident, they would take you. I think the law enforcement side, you have to be a citizen specifically. So that's a difference. That's a nuance between an immigrant and someone that was born and bred here. But apart from that, it's the same exact, you know, exact process. It really is. I mean, there's pros and cons. Like culturally, using north, south, east, and west, we don't do that in England. It exists, of course, you know, but our roads are like a bowl of spaghetti. So if you said go north on this one, you would for about 20 meters. Now you're going south and now you go, you know what I mean? So
that's the navigation. Interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot of cultural things where it was more challenging being from another country. But then conversely, you bring in a cultural skill set that, you know, some people in the department don't have. So for example, a lot of people speak Spanish in America. Well, I come from a country where French is our second language. And I say second, it's what we're taught in school. I'm not fluent. But so when I worked in the Haitian neighborhoods, that was super you know, helpful. And then the last place I worked, Protected Disney World, that we had a lot of English tourists. So I literally had times where they said, I can't understand a word he's saying. Can you get in the back and translate for me? And he was English. So So you've got, you know, there's the pros and the cons. But I mean, that once you have the documentation here, especially if you get your citizenship, which takes a few years, you know, then you're pretty much the same as everyone else.
Can you compare and contrast like the quals just with regard to what your prerequisites would be, or in even like what Academy of Life and the requirements are like in America versus somewhere else?
Yeah, so I know a lot of other countries, and it's interesting because there's a real diverse spectrum. Like Germany, firefighting is almost like a degree program. And I think some of the Northern Europe and Eastern European countries, you almost do like an academic test, and they place these kids, okay, you can do just this series of jobs. So the German ones are a very, very academic, intense course that they do. The UK is more like New York, where everyone comes in as a regular citizen and they train you from zero through. And I'm not super well versed in the British Fire Service because I didn't really actually get to enter the fire service till we got here. What's unique about the rest of America, though, is that most of us, especially when I was testing back in 03, 04, you basically put yourself through everything, you know, out of pocket. So you will put yourself through in Florida, what I know. We went to EMT school, and I went part-time because I was, you know, working to support myself, my family while I was going through. So I went to EMT school for 3 months, nights and weekends, and then fire school was 6 months. And so then you have those certs, and then you start applying. And now, as time's gone on, there's more departments that will do it with no qualifications. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if we touched on this when we spoke, but I've talked to a lot of guys that came on around my era or before. And like, for example, in California, I tested against 1,000 candidates in 2005, 04, 05 to go to California, Anaheim. And each of those candidates was already a firefighter, already a paramedic or EMT. A lot of them had worked in other fire departments already. They'd volunteered. They'd been the Explorer program. They worked on ambulances. Like, they had a resume, and there was 1,000 of these guys and, you know, a few women. And again, the diversity issue, that hall was predominantly Caucasian men. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about diversity, part of the conversation is, what are we doing to even bring the right candidates in the first place?
Right.
But now, contrast to now, and we can get into, I think, you know, some of the whys, but in 2024, these departments are all struggling to find people. So if you think about 1,000 people, they took 30 of us. Not saying that I'm the cream of the crop, because that would be obnoxious, but there's a reason why those last 30 were taken out of all that 1,000. Now, if you've got 40 candidates and you take 30, you get a very different mixture of people in that. Much. So it's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, I wonder, well, I mean, let's talk about those things right now, and kind of why you think it's changed so much. How do you go from 1,000 to, I mean, and this is an arbitrary number, you say 40, but I don't think that's too far off in a lot of cases. Just locally, I kind of know what some of the challenges and the struggles are, particularly in our local police department here in the city that I live in. People are not begging to be police officers here. And that creates a challenge versus 1,000 people that are really working hard and have been working hard for the better part of, you know, their early adult, you know, young teen life with a determination to earn a position and a job that they have desired for a long time and done all the prep work to do. And the difference, you know, the difference that makes in the respect and the honor, I guess, that they present or approach the job with. Let's talk about some of those things right now. I mean, you're no longer doing this, and we can talk about that later, but let's talk about kind of some of the things you're seeing from the outside looking in. Maybe kind of where you live and culturally versus maybe kind of what you're seeing on more of a global, and I mean that like maybe in the United States.
I mean, firstly, the reason why I'm not working anymore is because of the things that I'm saying, because it's so detrimental to our first responders that I ended up wanting to take the helm and be part of the solution. So it was never, ever, you know, a lack of love for the job. I adored being a firefighter. I didn't even promote. I loved being a firefighter, the one on the hose, the one, you know, cutting the car open. But if you think about the culture post 9/11, fire service specifically, there was a lot of admiration for firefighters. There was a call to action, the same as all our military members that saw the towers fall and, you know, signed up. You know, it wasn't chasing heroism. They wanted to be part of the solution. They wanted to, you know, to, and everything from revenge to making sure it never happens again and everything in between. But so we just went in blindly, this whole generation. And not that that's a bad thing, but all that had really been presented to us. I mean, you know, 343 firefighters died. So the danger of the job was there. And we know that it's dangerous. And we know that fire can burn and buildings can collapse. But aside from that, it was like, okay, you know, Marines, I know I might get shot. I mean, I might get captured. Okay, I understand it. Let's go. Firefighters, I know these are dangerous. All right, let's go. What's happened 20 plus years later, though, is a thing called the internet has now, rather than, you know, you're just on the yellow brick road with the Tin Man and Dorothy, all of a sudden now you've pulled the curtain back and you see the wizard. And it's not that it's malicious, but you actually see the whole fire service as it is. And, you know, like I said, the job itself, and I had an interesting talk with this with some fire wives the other day, it's not the job. This one wife said their kid had been all enamored with the fire service and he was young and he was now kind of a mid-teen. And the conversation would come up and come up about, are you thinking about being a firefighter yourself? And he was like, hell no. He said, you know, I forget what he said, but like, daddy's never home or something like that. So it wasn't the job. It was the work environment. It was the work week. So what I think is a massive kind of topic that's been missed by a lot of these conversations. People say, oh, it's these Gen Zs. They don't want to work, blah, 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 which is complete BS because Gen Zs are in uniform in every profession protecting this country.
Yep.
But what, you know, there's an element of course, that we have fewer people willing or able to do the job. I mean, 70% of us are obese or overweight. That's part of the equation. And our children, sadly, are getting less PE and shittier food in school. But also, now when I Google firefighter, there will be extrication, rope rescue, fight and fire, fire engines, tiller trucks. But there'll also be divorce, overdose, suicide, cancer,
alcoholism,
autoimmune disease. Exactly. And so it's not doom and glooming it, but it's like, okay, now everything's on the table. Let me evaluate. And wait, what was the pay again? Oh, shit. Really? Okay, we'll put that in. And what was the hours? Okay, well, that's kind of a long work week. Oh, wait, what? Mandatory overtime? So yeah. I'm ready to go home to my child's birthday. And then you tell me I can't because you're understaffed and I need to stay another 24 hours. You put all of these in a bucket and these kids are sifting through going, you know what? Amazon's sounding pretty good right now. I got to say, home every night, you know, 40-hour week, not 56, you know, stable paycheck, et cetera, et cetera. Don't have to worry about being sued, you know, because I didn't write a report properly. So that's, I think, what's happened. And the beautiful thing is great. So now we have the ability to start fixing all these things. But that's the real tug of war at the moment, is that requires courageous leadership. That requires some front loading of funds. I mean, the whole defund with the cops is ridiculous. You know, standards need to be put where they should be. There should be fitness standards, which is another entire thing. Police and fire have always resisted fitness standards, which I never understand. But we also need to put in training, gyms, you know, the things to enable the people to get back to the bar where they need to be. So this, we're at a real crossroads in the first responder professions. You know, I saw a clip the other day and it was a small, small department and there was a line of police vehicles, probably 11, I think, that are supposed to be manned that were unmanned in the parking lot. It's 11, you know, officers less that are going to respond to that shooting in your school. Or your teenager as they're lying upside down in a ditch, you know, whatever it is. So we, like I said, it's not doom and gloom, but we really are at that point now where either we finally get it and we support our first responders and fund and staff and put the bar back to where it needs to be, or we, you know, we don't have emergency services anymore. So I would argue most people would be more for option A, but that comes with requiring our leaders to do what they do, which, and ironically, it's the way we do it at the moment is false economy. It's all about budget, budget, budget. And we're bleeding money. Every time a police officer makes the wrong decision and someone sues a department for millions, that could have put 20 police officers in that would have mitigated that in the first place. You know, so yeah, rambling monologue about that, but that's kind of, I think, why we are where we are. But we were at 1,000 people testing just 15, you know, 20 years ago. So we can get back there. But we didn't know that was the case. So we all tested. Now we know it's the case. So now we have to get back to, well, if we fix it, people will line up outside these departments wanting to do these professions again. But, you know, if you went to a regular civilian job and they were like, yeah, 56-hour work week, you're not sleeping every third day, and I might ask you to stay 80 hours every other week, how many people would apply for that? So that's kind of, you know, where we're at.
I think it's compounded by, you know, I live in a very expensive area. I live smack dab in the Silicon Valley of Northern California here. Very expensive. Some of the richest soil or most expensive soil in the United States. We are trying to recruit first responders, and this is specific to firefighters. You just mentioned something about the pay, the quality of life or lack thereof that you may or may not get. And they can't afford to live in the city that they work in or work for. And so what's happened is it's just impossible. Even if you had two working people, like a couple, even if you had that, you're still probably not going to be able to live on a firefighter's income matched with whatever, let's just say a school teacher's income in the Silicon Valley. And this is like specific to firefighters where they're working maybe 3 days on, 2 days off, whatever it happens to be, whatever the working periods are. That's almost impossible, because then if you want to have kids and you want to have a life, like somebody's got to be home with those kids. You can't do that. We talked a little bit about your situation. I want to talk about that and you being a dad, but this is, and I want to talk about what you just outlined and what the ramifications of that are for you and the public. But one of the things that struck me just this year and sort of meeting with some politicians and wannabe politicians about what the problems are and knowing that and pushing them to understand or pushing them to walk through how they would make the decision to undo this, to change this, because they're constantly, we need to do a better job of recruiting, hiring, and retention, which means we need to pay people more. And they had a lot of like kind of upper level, top tier things. But what wasn't addressed is, where is that money going to come from? Because at the same time, the city budget is already millions and millions and millions in, you know, over the top. So who are you going to cut? And when those questions come up, there are never any answers, but they're politicking on these basic things. Now, going back to the firefighters that don't live here, here's how this impacts me in my brain. If we were to have a major disaster, and you mentioned 9/11, that is certainly a possibility. I am not a conspiracy theorist, and I don't sit around worrying about the doom and gloom all the time. I try to prepare for what might hit us in the side of the head and be prepared for it when the time comes. But let's say there was a major fire, a flood, a natural disaster of some kind in this area. Like 70% of our firefighters don't live within even an hour of the city center. So if they had to get here or come here, they may not even be able to get in. And so that is a ramification of the things that you're talking about. You're not paying them enough. So in order for them to get to live a lifestyle that makes any kind of sense on top of all the things that you just mentioned, they've got to live an hour and a half, maybe even as far as 2 hours away from here in community. And they can do that because they have the multi-day shifts followed by multi-days off. Can you walk through what some of the ramifications of all of this were for you, or what you saw when you were still with the fire service?
I mean, the proximity to where we work is a big thing. And you talk to the guys like, you know, a couple of generations before me, you know, they one of the things that made them sad was you used to have family picnics and do all these things in the community because the firefighters lived in the city. They did all these things together. And then, you know, that was it. As just like you said, as downtown areas or, you know, urban areas get more and more and more expensive, and more often than not, firefighter salaries barely move, you know, then we literally have to move further and further away. And I, just like so many others, I lived an hour and 15 away from most of my fire stations. There's a couple of times where I happen to live a little bit closer, but, you know, that was pretty much it, because like Orlando, for example, really expensive. And so, yeah, it does have a detriment to your ability to get to that place. I mean, when I say that, for example, in Florida, our big thing is hurricanes. Mm-hmm. Like I have been driving towards a hurricane when the rest of Florida is driving away. And it's just me and then some occasional, you know, power workers heading down. And so, you know, the artery roads are usually open unless there's something absolutely catastrophic. So we more often than not can get to there, you know, barring a massive earthquake or something that completely breaks the infrastructure. Where I think it's more important is when you think about the cuts that we've had in law, you know, law enforcement and fire, there's not really a picture painted on how detrimental that is to our response. So a much more powerful perspective, I think, is you live where you live and the neighboring fire station would have been the closest, but they're understaffed, so they had to brown it out. So now that fire station doesn't have anyone, or they had to send that rig to go cover like a mid spot between two. So now your little one starts choking and the crew that would have been, you know, 4 minutes from your house are now 12, 14 minutes from your house. And what really irks me is that the cities and counties don't go, hey, well, we're giving you a shittier service, but we're going to give you some of your tax money back. You know what I mean? So no one's telling them that when all this happens, their service is getting worse and worse and worse. And where I live now, there was a time and they've changed it finally, but Marion County here were doing what they call IFTs, inter-facility transports. So hospitals were paying them to take a patient from hospital A to hospital B. But that ambulance was the one that was close to your child that get ready for when they're choking. Now they're 50 miles away in Gainesville, dropping off a patient. So this is where, you know, I think the storytelling and the fire service has done an absolutely awful job of really telling the public what we do. We just have. But understanding the true human life safety ramifications of these cuts and these politicians' decisions, going back to, you know, someone's worst day, what do you expect on your worst day? Who do you expect to show up?
Right.
Is that going to go hand in hand with you be behind cuts and not supporting fire stations or, you know, law enforcement communities? Those don't, they're not, you know, they don't go hand in hand. If you're willing to let people take stuff away from the first responder profession, that's literally taking away from your family's safety as well. So I think that's rather than the proximity of where we live, which is an important conversation, it's more on your doorstep. Now, who should be coming versus who is actually going to be coming and where from?
Yeah, we have an interesting relationship. Our city has an interesting relationship with the ambulance company here in that it's a third-party contractor. It's not through the city. And so effectively, these medics are driving around, right? They're not located at a station. So they get, and so when the dispatch gets the call, they send fire. And you just mentioned what some of those issues can be. So they show up, right? Now they've called, now they, and so maybe they're late, right? And they're well beyond their, the reasonable response time or the required response time. This just keeps stacking up. And then they call an ambulance. Well, the ambulance is now behind what the response time should be because fire was behind the response time that it's been. Keep in mind that the city or the county, the city pays the ambulance company. Well, now the ambulance shows up and they're late and they get fined or the city gets fined for being late on this. So they're double dipping. They're not only are they paying the ambulance company to be late, right? They're paying them because they were late. At the same time, they're paying these fines. So, and the taxpayer, this is at the cost of the taxpayer, rather than putting the medics in the firehouses and staff fully staffing the firehouses in order for them to be able to respond to the calls in which they which that are out there with a staff that is has the ability to take care of business when they get there. It's mind blowing to the tune of millions and millions of dollars a year. As pockets are getting lined and we get continue, as you mentioned, to get worse service. So that's kind of how it impacts the citizen or the victims in these cases. Can you talk about how it affects the first responders and the ramifications there?
I mean, basically the best way to describe it is that we've just been asked to do more with less decade after decade. I mean, if you look at the calls, and this is a multifaceted problem, but that requires multifaceted solutions. But, you know, when I came on, some of the older guys would be like, oh, you know, back in my day, we used to run these calls, but you actually listen and they didn't. They weren't transporting. There were still private ambulance companies that did all the heavy lifting. So our younger firefighters now, I mean, literally, you know, a lot of them are working 24 hours straight. And they say, oh, you sleep, you sit around, you play. And when there's moments, of course, you know, in a 24-hour period, wouldn't you rest for a moment? Wouldn't you try and get a workout in or sleep?
You would hope.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that if you're talking about performance, you should. But so what's happening now is, and again, I'll give you kind of, this is the average American, you know, fire department. So we've done a horrible job. We have gone around for a long time saying what an amazing dream schedule we have. You know, I work one day on, 2 days off, or I work, you know, 10 days a month. And that is absolute fairy tale. You know, these first responders work a 24-hour shift. So that's three civilian 8-hour days mm-hmm. squished together in one. So it's 3 days on, 1 day off. And the second day, you know, we say it's my first day off. Like, we work from midnight to 8 a.m. That wasn't a day off. You were there the whole time. You didn't wake up next to your children and your wife. So you have that. And if you actually extrapolate that out, that's 30 days a month. So it's a 56-hour work week. But then with this increasing hiring crisis, and this was even when I was beginning my career, departments were understaffed when they had very little recruiting issues. So you get off, you know, like I said, 7 a.m., you're about to get in your car and go home. The phone goes and you're like, you need to stay another 24. So you got to tell your children and your loved ones that actually I'm not coming home for yet another 24 hours. So now that's an 80-hour work week, 80. And this happens in some departments, you know, frequently, like once every week, once every 2 weeks. I just had a guy from California on and they're CDF, I mean, they're working some of their people 5 days straight, 120 yep. hours. You know, it's absolute insanity. And if you...
I was just going to say, a buddy of mine a couple of years ago worked 42 days straight, no days off. Mm-hmm.
No, exactly. Yeah. But this is the point. People don't know, oh, you've got an easy schedule, you're always home. Listen to the actual thing. So how is it impacting us is the same origin story of why my podcast exists. Because about 10 years into my career, in 2 years, I went to 6 of my friends' funerals that I work with. Overdose, suicide, heart attack, cancer, autoimmune disease. I mean, everything. Like I said, we don't die of something, we die of everything. Whatever hits us first. And it's because, and just to parallel this with kind of like the whole COVID conversation, mm-hmm. no one's talking about the resilience of the human being. Even though it was, you know, lauded as heresy, the fact was during COVID, if you were a healthy man or woman, and even better, a healthy child, your chances of just having a shitty few days with COVID and then come out the other end were extremely high. If you had pre-existing medical conditions and you had high blood pressure and you were obese, your chances were a lot worse if you're a smoker. So, you know, that's just the health of the human being. The more we work our responders into the ground, the more chronically they disease and they die. And then the more acutely we make mistakes. So for example, you've got that police officer now who is, you know, overworked, underpaid, underslept, and now, you know, has his legs cut from under him because no one's supporting his profession anymore. And he's terrified of making a wrong decision. He's, you know, exhausted, pulls over a teenager freaks out, runs, you know, reaches for their glove box to grab their insurance papers. Cop thinks he's going for a gun, shoots him. You know, so these are the detrimental thing. Medic pushes the wrong drug. You know, police officer nails a minivan in an intersection. You know, these are the real life ramifications. There's an acute element which then factors into mistakes in uniform. And there's a chronic element which factors into the immense cancer, heart disease, suicide, overdose, you know, issues that we have in the first responder professions. And until we address the fact that they are working these insane amounts of hours, when everyone else is home in their bed, you know, we're missing the huge, huge part of the conversation. And going on the financial side, you're talking about the politician. I'm a complete idiot, but I remember one thing from my economics 101 class, which is the term false economy. Mm-hmm. If I go to a dollar store and I buy my child, you know, a plastic toy for 99 cents, and then 3 days later it's broken, and I got to keep buying another one. I should have just bought the $5 toy, you know, that was made by Tonka, and I'd still have it today. That's what we're doing in our first responder. The money is there, but it's in the back end with medical retirements, you know, workman's comp claims, overtime coverage, lawsuits, all the things. So all we need is these leaders to have the courage to say, look, you know, county or city, citizens, this is what's going on. This is where we're wasting the money. For 2 years, we're actually going to put, you know, an increase in tax. However, this is our guarantee. In year three, it's actually going to come down. And we're going to put the firefighters back when we took them off the engine. We're going to add, you know, 100 police officers on the street, because now you have this budget. But the problem is that requires you to look shitty in a budget year in front of your constituents.
That's right.
But that's true leadership.
Yeah, those are the tough decisions. That was the questions I was asking. Was like, where are you going to cut? Something's going to have to cut. You're going to have uncomfortable conversations, probably end some relationships, and institute a lot of accountability into some of the ones that may already exist there. And that is the, you know, we talk about leadership. You mentioned, you know, the Gen Zers. I see them as being very bright. They're just, you know, in a way, they're more educated than, you know, those that came before them, in terms of understanding the things that you mentioned, but also how to navigate there, and that they don't have to feel trapped. Like, there are other opportunities, and they're fairly self-sufficient to maybe try to go out and find those opportunities. And so you see a lot of them having a side gig, or, you know, or needing a side gig in order to kind of survive, which blows my mind after everything that you just said, that you have enough energy, you know, and time left over to do that. But going back to the leadership piece, we continue to vote for the same people that say they're going to make change and they do not. And we are stuck now in this vicious cycle where it's now escalated to the point where you mentioned this at the top of the hour, which was, we are, maybe it was phrased a little differently, but now we're left with a couple of choices where we're looking at this as being, many people I think are looking at this as choosing the lesser of two evils. And I think it's very easy to say this one is way more evil than that one. But then you just go on to the next point. You know, what's the next point? Is it really like, it's the score starts to look pretty even, and it's not good at the end. Nobody wins. So I wonder, like, just from you, what you've sort of outlined what needs to change, but how does that happen systemically inside the institution of the fire service? Who is it that does this? Is it a chief? Or is it the guys in the middle like you who just want to be firefighters, that have to stand up and influence things differently? Is it, you know, the captains that are in charge of multiple stations to rally the troops? How do you do it, man? That's the question I need answers to.
One of the challenges in the fire service specifically is that we are so siloed. You know, you literally have a city and a county that sometimes, in some examples, won't even talk to each other. And these are the same two departments that are going to respond,
yes,
in unison to a school, right, shooting, for example. And there are some great examples. That Anaheim's a good example of a network of surrounding cities that do absolutely work together. And I was proud to be a part of that department. But that lack of communication is a big problem right off. And we have a union that, my God, you ask them, they'll tell you they're the best freaking union in America. But they haven't done anything that I've seen in the last 14 years. And I'll just give you a perfect example. And they've changed leadership recently, to be fair, but still haven't heard any conversations coming out of it. But the most basal thing that a union is supposed to fix is the work week, the working conditions. And I have never heard a single mention of standardizing a proper work week. The 24/72 would be my thing that I would propose. But so it's the dissemination of knowledge. And I always say I like to get people educated and angry, you know, not just angry, but people that, you know, Trump and Biden, they just get angry. They, yep, don't even know why they're angry.
Yep.
You know, and like you said, the easier analogy is like, well, who do you prefer, Mussolini or Hitler?
Yep.
They're both really bad people.
Right.
Can we find some different ones? So yeah, I'm not saying they're both fascists, but I'm just saying lesser of two evils, like you said. So it's, how do you get to all these people, get their guard down, to educate them on the why, to get them to truly understand? Because the other thing about the first responder profession, they're so damn tired, they can't even think straight.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't really start challenging the system until you can have a calm mind and articulate properly.
Great point.
So that would be the first thing. And then, but it is everyone, you know, just to use, you know, again, that, you know, that president example. I've said this recently, expecting another person in this system to suddenly come in and be a great leader is like going to a turd factory and expecting a cupcake.
Yep.
Like, it's built to you know, to send the same kind of person out. They've got a different color tie, same exact person. And that applies to fire departments, it applies to cities and counties. So the only way I see change is that you really educate the masses and you get people that understand, which is one of the reasons why I started the podcast. And, you know, 900 plus episodes, it must be hidden. You know, I think there's almost 6 million downloads now. So 6 million times someone's heard one of the guests, you know, articulate an idea that's going to make them question the way that they've been taught. So if you can then kind of create a swell of understanding and then a reprioritizing, like, let me stop fighting for a pay raise this year. Let's fight for a different work week that actually can, you know, create an environment where our first responders get to go home more, get to see more of their kids' games or birthdays or, you know, another night with their partner, you know, having a romantic dinner, whatever it is. Those are so much more important. That's a real currency. Money is money. You know, there's always a bill that's going to suck up that extra dollar an hour that you fought so hard for. So, but it's everyone. It's the same nationally. You know, I always say this, there's that phrase, you want to change the world, start at home. And I believe that 1,000%. First, you look in the mirror and you figure out what about you is an issue. And every single one of us has that. And then you look at yourself as a parent and a partner and, you know, can I be better within my four walls? And then you step outside your front door and like, how can I be a mentor in my community? How can I help? I'm a strength and conditioning coach. I'm a mathematician, whatever it is. I'm a plumber. Let me go do some per diem work. The free work, whatever that fancy term is that lawyers use. But, you know, let me help some people. You know, let me go mow the drive of, you know, a veteran I know just came back from the Middle East or an elderly person, whatever it is. Just how can I make my little community, my street, my neighborhood a little bit better? And I think if that message, that every single one of us, it takes a village, we can all move the needle. When we start working on ourselves, I think the people that have been in this leadership positions that aren't doing what they're supposed to, it will be so much more glaring because all that clickbait white noise will be kind of dispelled because you're focusing on actionable things in your own home and your own community. And I think that is then how we'll get the groundswell of support. But if we keep, which I think is very deliberate, if we allow this kind of pigeonholing and division conversation that happens so much the last 8 years, that is the enemy of community.
I could not agree with you more. I wonder, what was the moment where you decided you weren't going to be fighting as a firefighter anymore and you were going to be fighting for firefighters, and maybe you could look at the broader terms for first responders and leaving the fire service to start the podcast?
So I started it while I was still working. Real kind of overview. Anaheim, you heard me speak very highly about. Hialeah was my first one. Great department. Awful, you know, lack of support by their city, but the department, the men and women that served in that department were phenomenal. And then I went to Orange County, which is the county that Orlando's in. Mixed bag, some phenomenal firefighters in there. And then, you know, they had a very low bar, so you have others too. But then the last place that I went to, and it was simply I was divorced and I was a single dad and this whole, you can't go home. Well, when you're a single parent, there's words that you can't tell me I can't go home. I've got a, you know, 3-year-old that needs me to be home. Mm-hmm. So I switched to a department that that protects the theme park here. And on paper, it was a good choice. My ego, they didn't get much fire, but ran a lot of EMS. And EMS is, you know, where you really save the lives. But they were fully staffed and they had what they call a Kelly day. So every 3 weeks, you got an extra day off, still nowhere near what it should be, but better. And it was a guarantee that I was basically going to always be able to go home to my son. The problem was, and I've talked about this many times, it should have been an amazing culture that the bar was set very high. They have some very unique, you know, potential rescues. They're a target hazard. But again, circling around to our point at the moment, if you have complacency and you allow people in leadership positions that aren't qualified to do so, and then that same kind of person has a fragile ego. So when the people that actually know what they're doing on the ground try and offer solutions, they tell them just, we don't have a problem, sit down, shut up. That's a very toxic environment. So after 5 years of trying to make things better, and then let me just say again, there are some very good firefighters within that department, but it's despite the department, not because of it. So I just rehabbed the meniscus tear surgery back to full duty. I never had any kind of medical retirement or anything. But I was going to these funerals. I started this podcast when I was about 2 years in. And I just had this kind of crossroads moment where I saw the anxiety within myself, not because of the job. I love the job, but because of the environment. And it was just detrimental. It was. And so that by this point, if the podcast had been downloaded, I think tens of thousands of times. And I was like, okay, well, this is clearly hitting. Actually, it might be a little bit more now, like the 100,000. But so I just took a leap of faith. I'm like, look, if I not only want to help the fire service, but walk the walk, I'm talking about all these things being, you know, detrimental to us. Well, I want to be home with my family. I would rather not get cancer, you know? So, so I ended up just taking a leap of faith, cashing out my retirement, which I had basically the equivalent of about 18 months, salary. So just cashed it out in one lump sum, gave myself a ticking clock. Like, all right, if I'm not making money by a year and a half from now, then I'm going to have to go back and, you know, join another one, number five. But it didn't happen. Luckily, 5.11 stepped in about 2 or 3 months before I ran out of money. And so ever since then, I'm not saying I've made a huge amount. I don't think I even make as much as I gave up, but that's irrelevant to me.
Right.
Because now, like I said, 6 million, basically, that's way more of an impact than I could have riding an engine or an ambulance and running one call at a time. Because when I leave, someone else is going to fill my spot. I'm not some, you know, irreplaceable superhero. I was just a firefighter. So that's where I am now. And that was about 5.5 years ago now. So it's kind of crazy to think that I've done this for all that time.
It is. I mean, you've come so far. I mean, 5 years ago, I mean, it's 6 million. 6 million? 6 million downloads? That's a lot. I when you think about I know the time and the effort that it takes to make that happen. I wonder, you know, when you got into it and where it started to where it is now, can you talk a little bit about the evolution? Because when you look at the diversity of guests that you have on, the show, it's well beyond simply, when I say this, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, it's well beyond just first responders. It covers topics and concepts that cross over. These are humans that you have on the show. So, you know, I think that's the main point of that. But can you talk about the evolution and kind of how it's evolved for you? And I have some follow-up questions to this.
So initially it was once a week, and it was funny. Sadly, this isn't the environment now, but 7.5 years ago, I sent out a load of emails to Tim Kennedy, Sebastian Junger. I mean, some pretty big names. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, going back to my sales days when I used to cold call on the streets of London years ago, you know, it was like a 1 in 10, like you pitch 10 people, probably one's going to buy. And that might be, you know, 100 people in the last 90 you get, but, no, like everyone said yes. So immediately I had like 2.5 months of recordings and I was like, oh, okay. So, I was putting it out, but I felt like it wasn't fast enough. I wanted to create this library because everything I do is just to build this massive resource that doesn't matter where on planet Earth you are. If you can speak English and you have Wi-Fi, you know, you can access it. Mm-hmm. So that was it at first, and I'm still working. So that's obviously pretty challenging when you're doing 24, 48-hour shifts and then coming back and trying to not be cross-eyed when you're listening to someone. but then the next real shift, I mean, obviously, I took the leap of faith, but in 2020, and we, you know, you and I talked in depth about your COVID experience.
Right.
What I saw right from the get-go, and it's interesting because, you know, I've always, because I'm not very smart, and I mean that, you know, not in a self-deprecating way, but just genuinely, I'm not all in some academic journey or anything. It's a very objective view, and when it first happened, as I mentioned, one of the things is, well, we're an unhealthy population. This is going to be more dangerous. The first responders are sleep deprived. This is going to be more dangerous for them and our doctors and our nurses. And no one was talking about that. It was just PPE and then it was vaccines. And so very early on, I ended up, So I'd gone up to 2 a week because I was struggling to put out enough. So I was at 2 a week, but when 2020 hit, I just was so sick of the lack of information, that just stay in your house, shut up, we'll tell you what to do mentality. And so I wanted to empower people in what they could do. So I put an extra episode out a week, which is why I've got, you know, 900, because three a week is, you know, you rack them up pretty quick. It's right, a lot of work. But I just wanted to accelerate this library and get as much out there. So whether it was the mental health side, nutrition, exercise, yoga, you know, whatever it was, things that people could actually do in their homes, they can listen and go, you know what? You know, there are some things that I'm going to start changing. You know, I'm going to work on my sleep. I understand sleep hygiene a little bit more now. Because the more scared that you made people, the more immunocompromised you made people. So it was the complete, I mean, I always said, if you wanted to write down a piece of paper, how would you maximize the chance of someone getting COVID-19, do exactly what they told
all
us
the things, all the things. Yeah.
And right there, you want to make people fatter and sicker? Well, then tell them that they can deliver fast food at their house. They can have alcohol and they can binge watch Tiger King. Nailed it. You know what I mean? So the polar opposite of what should have happened is that real coy, oh, let's not talk about it. You know, last year when the wellness community were like, are you going to finally say anything about this? And they just literally try to sweep it under the rug without any lessons learned. So
literally.
So that was when it went to three a week. And then, but it's a slow burn though. And I think this is the big thing. You know, you hear, you know, people that are successful with music or acting or whatever. And there's that term overnight success. You know, you see that we seem to have an actor that's the darling so often. But then you look back and they were in the Mickey Mouse Club when they were 12, or, you know what I mean? And they've actually been working for years and years and years. So I think the consistency is the big thing. Just being consistent, being, like you said, human. Like everything I do is to try and bring resources to people, solutions to problems. So I'm not talking about, you know, by my 12 DVD set or my national tour, because no one wants to listen to me talk. I don't. So my wife doesn't either. So it's just about, you know, when people see it's coming from a good place, I think that's another thing that's maintained that kind of growth. But you know, you've also got this shift of, you know, attention pulling, and now, you know, celebrities and people have these beautifully, you know, orchestrated podcasts, and there's, you know, in suits and there's a log fire in the background. And so there's a little ebb and flow too, because, you know, shiny objects appear constantly. But to me, if you trying to do a good thing, I think, you know, you'll always have people that are, you know, looking for help that hopefully trust the podcast as a resource.
Yeah, it's interesting. You just mentioned the bright, shiny objects. Everybody seems to have a podcast now, and things have, I've only been doing this a couple of years, but you can see a dramatic shift in terms of, you use the word attention pulling. I really think, like, when people are jumping over to these other things, the bright, shiny object, I think that's natural for humans to do. They kind of want to see what's new. What is everybody listening to? What is everybody else listening to? Sorry, what are the cool kids doing? With each one of these, what you see is sort of these new incomers or newcomers with the beautiful, you know, beautiful podcast studios that seem to be, you know, have all the latest and greatest. The editing is clearly, they're spending a lot of money. There's a lot of resource and money going into it. I try not to fault people for jumping over to those to hear maybe the more sensationalized story or the, you know, the thing that's a little bit more edgy, because why I think, and it does expose people to podcasting, and I'm still amazed at how many people don't listen to podcasts. They just don't. But there are those that are looking to be entertained. There are those that are looking for some education. And then I think there's the in-between. There's people that are looking for a little bit of both. It always surprises me when I look at it and I look at what the top podcasts are. And some of them you would expect. I mean, you got Joe Rogan out there who just continually does his thing. I think he's done an excellent job with it too, in my opinion. But like comedy, right, it tends to be, you know, one of the bigger ones. Crime, mystery crime stuff. Tends to be one of the more popular, you know, type of genres. And I think about this and I think, well, why are people looking? They're just looking for something. They're looking for something different. But I do think, you know, if we circle back to kind of what you've done and your audience and the following that you have, I do think there is a larger part of this population that looks quietly or listens quietly to podcasts like yours to try to have a better understanding of just humans in general. They're not looking for the bright, shiny object. They may want to go check that out. And they'll do that. And I would never fault them for that. So maybe you get a little bit less, a few less downloads now. But I think part of the other thing is when you release three a week, that's a lot of content for people to listen to, right? So, you know, like if you're, especially my podcasts are, if I record with somebody, it's at least an hour and a half, some closer to 2 hours most of the time. So if somebody's listening on their commute, they're generally not commuting 2 hours, they commute maybe 15 minutes. So if they're listening on their commute, it takes them a whole week, you know, maybe to get through an episode or whatever. My point of this is if you have more volume, you would think that would equate to total, you know, more total downloads. But when you're pitching to the same audience or whatever else, maybe the math doesn't work out that way. I just, going back, my point of this is I do believe people are looking for the more intelligent conversation. I believe this platform is the best one to deliver that because it's safe. Getting canceled is, I don't want to say it's impossible. Where there's a will, there's a way by any platform to do that. But you're not going to get canceled. You aren't going to get censored. It is very organic. And I think people, whether they understand it or not, they tend to gravitate towards that more than what seems to be very contrived and produced, if you will. And that's the interesting part about the way you've presented on the platform. One of the things you said to me when we first talked, which was, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks ago, we talked on the phone. You're like, look, nobody's going to be watching a podcast on YouTube. And so everything that you do is audio, And you have 6 million downloads. I mean, that's incredible. So you, despite the fact that so many people have moved to YouTube, including myself, I have, you know, we put as much into YouTube as we do into the other platforms. You've managed to do this on one platform, which I think is really impressive. I wonder how you feel about that. And if you feel like you're getting, if what you set out to do in terms of making an impact from the other side in a different way is working.
See, my decision for that is twofold, if not more. Firstly, it's just efficiency. I get people say, you know, hey, you guys, thanks for the show, or, you know, tell your crew, whatever. And I'm like, this is it. You know, everything from packing t-shirts and sending to them, you know, when I do a very limited run, to editing, to, you know, everything. So, you know, you have to choose, I think, what you get your biggest bang for, you know, for your buck. And if it was, you know, a 5-minute interview show with, you know, in a nice studio or whatever, then I'm sure I would put it on. But, you know, I love Joe Rogan. I love Tim Ferriss. I love other people that know they're on YouTube, but I listen to them on Spotify, or used to be, I forget the one of the podcast apps before that. But same. And even YouTube, I don't subscribe to YouTube, so I can't have YouTube on, because if I want my screen to turn off, it stops. Right. You know? So I just find YouTube really fucking annoying, to be honest. Yeah. But that's just me.
Same. I have a huge aversion to it, if I'm being honest. Yeah.
So, but the other thing, and I mean this, you know, wholeheartedly, I love the anonymity of not having your face plastered everywhere, because then the focus goes on the guest, you know. And then every so often I'll pop on and I'll do a video on social media or something, and then I hope people will go, oh, you know, he doesn't come on very often. Let's listen to what he's got to say. Because that, I'm only going to go on if I feel like it's something very pertinent. But by removing that video image, because I just don't think, like you and I, this isn't very fun to watch. But right, someone's driving, mowing the grass, cooking, working out, whatever, it's engaging because you're listening to it, just mm-hmm. like the old school, you know, interview shows on the radio. So for me, it's like, okay, even though, yes, I would probably get a few more plays if I did all that on YouTube, I kind of like the fact that my face is kind of, you know, behind the shield, as they say, you know? So I like that singer Sia. You know, she always has that crazy hair over her face because she wants people to listen to her music, not see if she's pretty enough to be a pop star. Mm. So that's another part too. There are, you know, some shows like Joe, when he has guests on, and you know, Tim Kennedy bought him a gun once. I'm sure it was kind of cool to watch that and see it on the camera. And hey, Jamie, pull this video up. That's a different application. But for me, you know, the audio is the medium. And if I lose some people on the video, then, you know,
so be it.
Yeah, it is what it is. You can't get everyone. But it goes back to, again, that trust. And the thing is with the three a week, because I thought about that too. Like, how are people going to be able to keep up? But then I realized, you know, there's only certain episodes that catch people's eyes. I don't listen to Joe really with his UFC fighters. I love UFC, but I don't need a breakdown of a fight. Right. That's not interesting to me. His comedians, a lot of time, not really big, but I love, you know, his Robert Kennedy and all the guests that, again, you're gonna leave with some knowledge. You're gonna understand something a little differently. So I'll pick and choose Joe's episodes. So I think that's the immersive thing for me. The beautiful thing about podcasts is those episodes are there as long as you pay, you know, the website. So, you know, people will Google, you know, Clint Emerson or, you know, someone I did years and years ago, Buck Brannaman. And they'll be like, oh, wow, he was on this podcast. And that's sitting there from, you know, 4 years ago. So that's the other thing is, you know, there isn't enough time. So for me, what I love is, you know, you want to listen to, for example, a Chicago ER physician that was in Gaza a few weeks ago doing humanitarian aid and his very middle of the road humanitarian perspective of mm-hmm. what's going on. Then Thayer Ahmad is your person, you know. So you can Google it, and this is the good thing with technology getting better. The ability to search and pinpoint the kind of podcast that you want to listen to is getting better and better.
So interesting about that with the pinpointing things. I wonder about how you look at things from like a metrics perspective and the measurements, because I've found that in podcasting, it's a little interesting in that what it is it's very limiting. There's only so much information you can grasp, say, from analytics, obviously downloads, where they're coming from, a little bit of the demographic thing. But how do you make decisions around the analytics that you do get? Or do you at all? That's what I thought you'd say. Yeah.
You could drive yourself crazy with that. And even recently, like I just switched because I was on SoundCloud for 7 years, basically. And then they kind of imploded and I was writing to them and the customer service was, I mean, it was horrendous. Like I'd wait, you know, a week for a response and then get some, you know, AI bot reply. Mm-hmm. And they were just, the metrics were completely corrupted. So I moved over and even then, you know, it started off with this new platform. Obviously, it takes a while for it to kind of figure out the metrics, and then it was up, and then it goes down. But you can get obsessed with the metrics, and then you're like, "Wow, why isn't anyone pressing play? You know, this week, what's going on? You know." But it might just simply be that it's March Madness, or you know, Trump's court case, or whatever. You know, extremely enriching thing that you're watching instead.
Exactly.
You know. So, but it's a distraction, and I'm writing a second book now, and I'm telling myself, don't even freaking look. Like this book is the thing at the moment that will be the next interesting thing that I put out into the world. But it's ebbs and flows, you know, it really is. And COVID, obviously, podcasts did really well because people had a lot of time and they were looking for solutions, you know, and then people got out and, you know, I feel like it's dipped down a little bit. And then even an interesting thing that I didn't know and I Googled it is that Apple, if you subscribe to a podcast, it used to auto download every single episode that you put out. So the metrics are all of us. So, you know, 6 million and 6 million, but, you know, Joe Rogan's and Tim Ferriss and everyone, a lot of them were being downloaded. Doesn't mean they were being listened to. So
right.
They switched it, which made everyone's metrics, I mean, a fraction of what they were. Because mm-hmm. now I think you have to consistently listen for it to keep downloading the next one. So, which is good. I mean, it sucks for your ego because you're like, oh, I'm getting less than I was. But
it's real.
I want people to hit play. That's my main thing. So regardless of how many zeros, I want every single number to hopefully represent someone has learned something from Scott or whoever else came on the show.
So over 900 episodes. I mean, it's a tough question because if you asked me this, I know how tough this would be for me to answer. But is there a specific episode that really stands out for you that very much impacted you or the show in some kind of way? I mean, whether it's positive or maybe it's traumatic at some level. I don't know. What can you tell me?
There's a few elements. I think one of the saddest things is the people I've had on the show that have passed away since. I had a lady, Amy, who was on. She was one of the Camp Lejeune cancer, you know, victims from the contaminated water. And she passed away a few weeks after. She just had a firefighter who had cancer who was going to be coming on. And we postponed because he just wasn't feeling well. And he slipped into a coma and he passed away a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Those are the really, they're sad. That they're more sad if I haven't got them on the show because at least, you know, there's that hour and a half for the children to listen to or their department or whatever. So it's a very powerful thing. But it's, you know, it is sad. You look at this list and you're like, wow, there's, you know, 10 people aren't here anymore. As far as like powerful ones, I always refer to one of my friends, Dustin Hawkins, episode 39. That was the first time, if I'm not mistaken, that someone really bore their soul, you know, and I literally got so many comments after saying, dude, I was in the gym on the rower. One minute I'm laughing, next minute I'm crying. People thought I was a lunatic because they were listening to the podcast. But so those are some of the most moving ones. And it moves me when another human being trusts me so much that they will be vulnerable. That is the ultimate compliment, I think, for any human being, that you can sit with them and they feel comfortable enough to talk to you completely. So not picking up specific episodes, but when I've got to that, I mean, I've had some where you can tell this is just that person's 200th interview and they're going through the motion. You're trying to kind of lead them in different ways, but very unfulfilling to me. Yes, we'll learn about your, you know, some of your work and it'll definitely add value to that episode. But, you know, I like it when I really, really engage with people. And it's even more amazing when they're outside this profession or the military, because now you've got, you know, a Dutch model or a dancer or, you know, people that are way, way out that are still trusting you and having these conversations. And that's where, like you said earlier, with the spectrum of guests, that we all do a spectrum of things, but the commonality is we're all human beings having the human experience.
Yeah, I think I probably have to answer that same question similarly, minus the death part. I have not experienced that yet. That's going to be very, very challenging. But I've had it. There's been a few times, a few episodes where I really had to pull myself together just to kind of make it through when somebody's really kind of, you know, just given everything they've got and laid it out there on the table. And then afterwards said, you know, I never really told that story before in that way. And that's pretty special, going back to no metric can measure that. It makes me feel very privileged to even be, you know, have you on the show to somebody that really respects and honors that in the way that you just did in telling that story. And those are the important pieces. It wasn't some fantastic story or funny story or something that impacted you personally from like a financial or followers or downloads, you know, perspective. That is why I started my own show, was to help people and to get a message out. And I started for the first year, I told the guys that were helping me with it, I said, I don't even know what the metrics say. I don't want to know. I don't want to see what the comments are. I don't care. I just want to do what I think is the right thing. So, I mean, it's gone beyond the podcast. That is for sure. Talk about the books, James. I mean, what can you tell us about the books?
So I wrote my first one. Ironically, I just started writing it before COVID happened. So that was, you know, somewhat good timing, I guess. Mm-hmm. But about 3.5 years ago now. But what I wanted to do initially was, I didn't want to write a biography or anything, because A, back then I was only 46. And B, you know, I didn't have a spectacular life. You know, interesting, you know, stunts and all that stuff. You could read it and go, okay, this is different. But what I wanted to do was take stories from my career and my life, and then in each chapter, create takeaways. So the story might be sleep deprivation. You start in the fire station, the tones go off, and then you're driving a tiller truck down the road. Now you're on the roof with a chainsaw, you know, and you're just now starting to wake up and there's fire around you. And then we talk about sleep deprivation and sleep hygiene. So that was the first one. It's called One More Light, Life, Death, and Humanity Through the Eyes of a Firefighter. Was super lucky. Josh Brolin actually wrote the foreword for that book, which I always tell people is funny because he voiced the foreword on the audiobook too. So you've got one of Hollywood's best voices and then my squeaky ass voice reading the rest of the book. But then the second one, I won't go into too deeply, but it will be revealed quite shortly. But what I wanted to do was actually shift to fiction so I could create a story. And the reason being, you know, you and I have a podcast, you know, I've written a book. So we're hitting all these different mediums of how can we help people, as you mentioned, a lot of people don't listen to podcasts. Well, how can I get to the readers? Well, the biggest piece is how can I get to the people through their screens? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write a book, and I hope the book is a phenomenal read, but the real pipe dream is to make it into a show on Netflix or Amazon or something. Because I want to tell the story of the real fire service, not the Chicago fire, not the, you know, the backdraft, or God forbid, some of those even, you know, worse, cheesy soap operas they got out there.
I can't.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like Chicago Fire, I had Steve Chikorodis on, who's the real Chicago chief behind that show. But, you know, he was very PC in the way he presented it. But basically, he presents an idea and a story, and then Hollywood goes, and then they, you know, then it
they
comes
do their
out.
Thing.
Yes. And all these models are now walking around a fire station. But, you know, even in, someone made a great point, even in reality TV where they follow fire departments, it's always a success story. They always make the rescue. The cardiac arrest survives, which is, in my whole career, I never saved a single person in full cardiac arrest. Mm-hmm. Worked hundreds of them. So that's the reality. And it's not making it doom and gloom, but it's again, it's pulling that curtain back and seeing the wizard as well, like bringing that into the conversation. But at the same time, and I think this really is important when it comes to the law enforcement conversation, everyone points at our cops and go, why are they not doing better?
Yep.
But no one points at the streets of America and going, why do we have so many gangs? Why do people shoot up our schools? Why do we have so many homeless? And why is there a fentanyl crisis? And so it goes back to trauma. It goes back to that origin story. But after all these conversations, I realized that so many people, granddad was not okay. And more often than not, granddad was in World War II. And so we look at the last domino. We don't forget to look upstream how many dominoes fell before that. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a fusion of the modern day fire service, but there will be an origin story that will take you back two generations. So hopefully it will reframe people who are struggling, who found themselves in a bad place, with compassion and empathy again, rather than judgmental. So that's kind of the concept.
I love it. I can't wait. How can I help you and the audience help you sort of get the message out there about the things that you're doing, the people you're talking with, and the mission that you're on?
I mean, if there's an episode that you like, obviously listen to it. I mean, it's the same, you know, with yours, with all of us. And this was funny when people come to me, sometimes they say, you're going to start a podcast in the fire service. Like, oh, we don't want to step on your toes. I'm like, I didn't invent podcasting. You know, the more the merrier, as long as it's coming from a good place, you know, if you're trying to make things better. So for me, it's not even how you would follow, you know, my one. It's just, be hungry for that information. I mean, you know, I have social media and stuff, but even then, does that really change anything? No. So it's the word of mouth is a big thing. If there was something, you know, your podcast, my car podcast, that truly moved you, that you know, helped in some way, shape, or form with one of the guests, share it. That's the big thing in the podcast world. I mean, I don't know if you have the same. When I post my promo videos, very little traction on the whole algorithm, you know? So really all podcasters have to do is word of mouth, you know? So if it really helped, and I say this on the intro of every single one of my shows, just share it. Just tell one person, because I truly subscribe to that thing, which again, pushes against the metrics. If you help one single person, then all of this was worth it. So if you enjoyed it, then think, okay, who else? Let me put it on my social media, or let me send it to a friend. Because this is what I love about 900 plus episodes. You tell me, James, you know, I'm struggling. I'm thinking about plant-based diets, or my sleep is kind of shit, or you know, whatever the thing is, I can say, all right, I'm going to send you two episodes. Mm-hmm. Listen to those and then get back to me and we'll talk more. You know, so it's like homework. So this is the beautiful thing about podcasting. If something helped, share it. That's all I would say.
Couple final questions as we close up here. One would be, for the current firefighter, the person that's currently in the fire service that may be struggling with some of the things that you talk about on a regular basis that we've even talked about today, what kind of advice could you give them, or what do you want them to know, you know, in terms of maybe coming through their, finding answers to their issue, or finding some, I guess, maybe some being more grounded and making some decisions on what might be the right thing for them to do?
I think one of the first things is to give yourself some, what's the term, grace. So understand, if you are an American firefighter, unless you work in a really progressive department with a great work week and loads of resources, and you know, then that's a different conversation. But for a lot of them, understand that you're working in a profession that set you up for failure. And it's not malicious. There's not people wringing their hands, you know, wanting to destroy firefighters and bury them, but that is what's happening. So, you know, you're tired, your relationships, you know, struggling, you're kind of on edge with your kids, whatever. This is partly because of the profession that you signed up for and the environment that we're working in now. So, but the conversation that needs to happen is hope. Like, for example, there is a podcast called Behind the Shield with 906 episodes that contain the solutions to the things that you're struggling with. And even with the kind of mental health side, I think this is a really important conversation. I just interviewed a SAS soldier from the UK who was also addicted to heroin for 5 years. And you know, his observation was this, you know, the PTSD story is kind of being talked about too much. Mm. But, you know, and we went back and forth in a very positive way. And I was like, I don't think it's too much. I think we're having the wrong conversation. It's still stuck on that stigma. Let's smash the stigma. Well, smashing the stigma doesn't get you to the resources that you need. Right. Smashing the stigma doesn't also give you hope. And the thing is, post-traumatic growth, working through what it can be a physical injury, a mental trauma. When you come out the other side through PT, through counseling, through ayahuasca, whatever it is that works for you, is a better version of yourself, a better father or mother, husband, wife, firefighter, police officer, soldier. So I think that's the other thing, is knowing that A, the tools exist, they do. And anyone listening, message me if you need the resources or the kind of go-to episodes to start you on this journey. But B, the inspiring, exciting element of hope that you can be a better person if you go through the crucible, finding the tools that work for you. So yeah, that'd be my kind of, you know, ending comment, I guess.
That's an excellent, excellent ending. You answered indirectly the second question was what would you tell or what advice could you give somebody that may be aspiring to do this? And I think you just nailed it. Like, do your research, and you've got 906 episodes to do that through. You know, if you listen to the Behind the Shield podcast. James, I don't know what to say. Again, I mentioned it, with at risk of overdoing it, I'm honored to have had you on here and talk with you. But, you know, with all that's been accomplished on your end and the people that you talk to and the impacts that you're making in people's lives, I just appreciate having you on and you giving me your time today. It's been a lot of fun. I learned a lot about you. I mean, it's interesting when you get to talk to the guy that's behind the mic, typically answer, you know, asking all the questions. I'll be honest, I've never listened to you be interviewed before. So this is the first time. I've listened to you interview a lot of people, and I admire the way you do it and how you handle yourself as a professional. And I think you're somebody that everybody that's, you know, aspiring to do a podcast or is currently doing one, like myself, can look up to. So I want to just thank you for sharing and being open and giving me your time today.
Yeah, well, likewise. I mean, firstly, thank you for being part of the solution. You did the same kind of call to action that I did, you know, and you stepped up and got out of your comfort zone and stood behind a microphone and, you know, learned how to interview just like I had to, you know, you know, learn to listen, like truly actively listen. But, you know, I feel like we're all part of the same kind of tapestry. And there is this paradigm shift of people that are, like you said, that kind of unfiltered, but proactive, actionable conversations that will inspire and bring people together and make them realize, oh, we can actually make a difference. So it's always an honor when I get to come on and have a conversation. And obviously, as we touched on, you came on my show, which should probably be people listening in episode 910-ish, 12, something like that. But, you know, this is what's been so cool about this. Like yesterday, I was in your position and now we flipped it around. And, you know, what an amazing thing for two people to have such an in-depth conversation and then be able to record it. And hopefully someone listening will go, I think that might help. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So thank you so much.
So that's, I think just to finish this up, we talked about it, or we said the name, it's Behind the Shield podcast. Where do people go to get all 906 plus episodes going forward?
My website is jamesgearing.com, 2 E's in the last name. The actual show is on all the platforms, but as you said, not all 900. I learned this recently that, you know, they only have like 300 to 500 on their list usually. So the website is the best place for all of them. And then the social media, the best place is Instagram, Behind the Shield 911.
Well, you heard it here. James, just one more time, thanks so much for your time, man. I appreciate you. And I know you're very busy and you probably need some rest. So go rest easy, spend some time with your kid and keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Iron Sights. If you enjoyed our conversation, you can support our mission by hitting the subscribe button, leaving a review, and sharing the podcast with a friend. I'll see you on the next episode.